In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, Devin Clancy. Hi, Devin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. It's nice to, I've heard you on other shows. It's nice to be podcasting with you directly.
You've heard me on one other show. This is the second
time. Well,
that's
time true. That's true. Yeah, that's true. Really, it was just the V episode. Yeah. But really, you weren't on. Why do I feel like I heard you on something else? I guess I'm completely wrong. I'm getting old and my memory
I send you guys complaint letters. You might have read some of those.
Maybe that's what it is. We get a lot of those. So, yeah. thank you again. Thank you for being here. We're here to talk about Super Friends number 39. Which was on sale September 25th, 1980. But before we get into your history with the Super Friends, if you have any, and then this issue in general, we do have to thank our sponsor, which is InStockTrades.com. This episode of For All Mankind is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Devin, what do you got?
I brought the new Teen Titans Omnibus Hardcover, Volume 1, 2022 edition. I think it's that might be the third time they've done this. But it collects the beginning of the new Teen Titans era, 1 through 20, DC Comics Presents 26, and a bunch of other stuff. And the reason I picked it is because Romeo Tangal, who did the Wonder Twins story in the backup of this issue, was an inker on some of those issues. I'm not sure exactly how many, but... he was involved, and they came out pretty much exactly at the same time. So a loose connection, perhaps, but still, you know, interesting.
Well, wait till you hear mine in terms of loose connections. But that's an absolutely great selection. Did you buy New Teen Titans like as it was coming out, or have you gone and read it since?
I went back to it. I when it was first coming out, and I was aware of it. It was further along than this. It was probably like 1985, 86, and it seemed really cool, but like very involved, and I couldn't necessarily figure out exactly what was going on with it. So I did pick it up later, kind of in the Marv Wolfman writer's block era, I guess. But then I went back, and the first time they put out this omnibus, I actually bought it and read it then. And people said it would fall apart if you read it too hard. So I don't know. I think this is a correction on that.
Okay. Well, it's an outstanding pick for me, because this issue's story features cloning. As part of its plot, okay. I typed the word clones in the Aronson Stock Trades search bar. And the first thing it pulled up was a comic book adaptation of Star Wars Attack of the Clones. But I'm not going to punish the audience like that. Okay. So I went with something else. I went with What If Classic Complete Collection Volume 3. Now, of course, that's a Marvel book. I never like, wait a minute, what does that have to do with DC? Well, this reprints What If numbers, the classic series, numbers 24 through 35, which featured stories like What If Phoenix Had Not Died? What If Wolverine Had Killed the Hulk? What If There Was No Fantastic Four? What If Bullseye Had Not Killed Elektra? What If The Avengers Were the Last Superheroes on Earth? And what if Spider-Man's clone had survived? So there's our connection, even more tangential than Romeo Tangal. This is 448 pages of alt universe goodness. The normal price is $39.99, and stock trades price is only $24.79. You save 38% off. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, visit instocktrades.com, and we thank them for their support. Okay, Devin, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about Super Friends number 39. But since this is your first time on the show, and as you pointed out, your second podcast ever, What if any, what history do you have with Super Friends of the Comic?
So around my friend's fourth birthday in, 1978, we saw the Superman, the movie, and as part of his birthday party. And I was totally into Superman. So naturally everyone's like, you know, there's a cartoon you could watch in the, you get up on Saturday morning and my parents are like, you know, go ahead and watch TV at 8 a.m. Don't bother us. and that's fine. So I became a big fan of Super Friends around that time. And, also it was on, you know, weekday mornings before school and stuff like that. When they would actually air some of the older ones, which is Challenge of the Super Friends, which is of course, you know, legendary. And so it was really my introduction to like TV that I specifically wanted to watch on purpose, you know, appointment television, we'd call it these days. And, you know, we didn't have a VCR or anything. So I had to wake up in time to see it and figure out the channel and everything like that. So it became, you know, one of my favorite shows. And so at some point, a family member or somebody bought some of those Whitman reprints, like the three packs. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of Super Friends comics that I don't think made much of an impact on me, or they left them at my grandparents' house or something, because I didn't have them like around all the time, but I definitely looked at them. And then when I got into comics sort of officially, when I was about 11 or 12, a few years later, somebody gave them to me. Oh, you have these comics and check these out. And so I had probably 4 or 5 or 6 or so of the Super Friends reprints, and you know, various other ones that sort of kind of was into, but not really. But I appreciated the Super Friends ones because being, you know, a tie-in comic to a show I already liked, it was kind of a natural thing. And then when I was first learning about back issues and sort of looking for interesting stuff to buy, it was another thing where it's like, they were cheap and they were like, to me, a known quantity because I was familiar with the show and I had some of the other comics. So it was like, that's something I could seek out and get for, you know, 75 cents, a dollar, something like that, or even less. So there's some of the first back issues I bought. So I probably over time collected about 10 or 12 of them. And I think I had number 25, which had Overlord in it, and also the Global Guardian. So I kind of thought Global Guardians were like a really big deal, like an official thing. Like I hadn't realized at the time that, you know, they hadn't really never appeared anywhere else except for DC Comics Presents and Who's Who. So it was like, you know, I thought they were, you know, a pretty cool thing. And it's like, oh, there's all these other superheroes in other countries. That makes sense that, you know, we must see those all the time. And of course, you know, we don't. But
there must be 6 Global Guardians titles or something just to accommodate all these characters. Tuatara alone must be a big deal in the DC.
And then even when I was like, you know, 11 or 12 or 13, I was kind of still into like what you would consider like kids comics. So I still appreciated the, you know, the Superpowers comic and other stuff like that that was coming out at the time.
Outstanding. There was one season of Super Friends that I think when I read it, it aired like at 7 a.m. or something. I thought, my God, like, did I get, I remember watching the Super Friends. I'm like, did I really get up that early to watch the Super? Like, did the ABC hate the Super Friends? Like, why would you put it on so early in the morning for pizza?
Yeah. There's actually an ad in this book that shows all the stuff that was on after Super Friends. And I watched every single one of them. So I literally just sat in front of the TV all morning. There's no question there.
70s parroting at its best.
Yeah. And also when I would go up to my grandparents' house in Boston, for some reason, there's a channel there that would show the Wendy and Marvin episodes. So I had no idea who they were until then. I went up there. And so it was like, you have your Mountain Comics and I had like Boston TV because things were different up there.
that's going to be its own show, Boston Comics. We'll start that on the network. We'll talk off air about that. Sure. So, well, that again, that is fantastic. I mean, that's great. I had those Whitman comics. I love those three packs. I've mentioned on other shows that like I would love to do a one-off episode on those three packs, but like they're impossible to research. You know what I mean? Like, there's no information on them anywhere, and they're so expensive. Like to buy them now, you go on eBay and it's like even the cheapest, crappiest ones are like $30. Like, I can't wait.
You know, every so often someone finds one that no one knew about. So it's like, there's either 100,000 of them or 20. I don't know.
Right. Exactly. Like, when did they Korax, Son of Tarzan? Was it a three pack? When did they do that? Yeah, absolutely. So,
and I got unlucky because one of the ones I had was the Justice League of America issue where they're trying to induct Black Lightning and they spend the entire time trolling him in other costumes. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't really read. So I was like, where the hell is Superman and Batman? This is like, who are these people?
This book sucks. Give me the Global Guardians. So, well, that's awesome. That's great. That's a marvelous origin story. So, Regarding Super Friends number 39, as I mentioned, it was on sale September 25th, 1980. The main story is the future son of Overlord. There is, again, you know, from for all you knew, Devin, Overlord's a big villain, right? You know, he's like a big
up there with
big,
Lex Luthor.
Yeah, he's a Joker and Overlord. He's really one of the big comers of the DC universe. Before we get to the story in question, what do you think of this cover? We've got, you'll see it on the gallery post, of course, on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You've got the Overlord, or at least a version of the Overlord, bursting in. He's huge. He's like 20, 15 feet tall. And yet the Super Friends are all relaxing, and they can't be bothered to deal with this threat. Aquaman is getting a cup of water out of the why am I blanking on the
water cooler?
Water cooler. I am getting so old. Wonder Woman is knitting. Robin is watching cartoons. Superman is kind of just sort of not really is pointing at the comic book that Batman is reading, which just happens to be Mystery of in Space for some reason. I don't know why he's reading that book. But what do you think of this cover, Devin?
So when you asked me if I'd like to be on the show and which issue, you mentioned a couple. And so I looked through the covers on Mike's Amazing World of Comics. And I was like, this one actually appealed to me and made me want to read it, which is a really weird experience for a 48-year-old man. It's like, it's like walking into the store and seeing a bunch of comics. Well, that's an interesting cover. I want to buy that. And thinking back, I really have literally almost never had that experience because, you know, by the time I was 11 or 12, I was going to comic stores so I could read what was coming. I knew what was coming. I could read previews or whatever they called it back then. And I didn't pick up stuff just because I saw the cover very often. Like I kind of knew what was coming and I bought what I liked. So this is a really weird experience to see a comic that has an interesting cover and that makes me want to read it because it's just so ridiculous.
It's a great, yeah, it absolutely. I mean, I was buying Super Friends regularly. I mean, I bought it all the way to the end, but had I not been, and I just saw this one, I would have bought this one because it's just such a goofy cover and beautifully drawn by, of course, Ramona Fraiden and Bob Smith. You've got, first of all, I compliment this every time I can because I just continually need to underscore how hard it is. Wonder Woman sitting in the chair and her legs are up and they're foreshortened. That is really hard to do. As someone who was never able to draw it correctly, she makes it look effortless. And as also I've mentioned on other episodes, I love any story where the superheroes are kind of like palling around, you know, they're just being kind of hanging out. And so I love Superman and Batman reading a comic book together. It's Superman pointing a panel out or something. I just think it's just very charming.
Yeah. And I mean, it's such a wacky cover. It's almost like it almost oversells what actually happens in the book to a certain extent, because this is kind of like a funnier beat. And I was trying to figure out what comic Batman's reading. So I don't know if he's picked up like the 1980 revival of Mystery in Space.
I'm assuming that's what it is. Yeah.
He's got Ultra the Multi-Alien issue, because that's kind of purplish.
Yes. Or
it's possible he's picked up like the Fireside book collection, because that kind of also has a purplish pinkish cover. So maybe he's like, you know, reading a trade paperback.
That was way more thought put into that than I ever would have expected, Devin.
No, I looked at it a long time.
I assumed that because Mystery in Space had just been restarted, that was probably like Julius Schwartz's or E. Nelson Bridwell's suggestion. You know, maybe that Ramona didn't pencil in the title. She just drew a magazine. And then they were like, you know what? Let's make it a plug for something else that we're publishing. So let's make it Mystery. Because it's like, again, not that Batman isn't a Renaissance man, but you would think he would not be reading Mystery in Space of all the DC comics to be reading. That I wouldn't think a sci-fi one would be something he'd be
interested. Superman's pointed to it. He's like, oh, that's Adam Strange. Remember him? Like, yeah. But something about like actual comics on the cover of a comic like really appeals to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like a little bit meta or something like that, but I like that.
It's really great. It's beautifully composed. You know, this guy is bursting through the main part of the, you know, the center of the cover with these two giant ray guns, and then the five super friends are just hanging out. So it's an absolutely marvelous cover. And as you said, and we'll see that in a moment, it really does oversell what happens in this story exactly. But okay. So let's get to the plot. It's called The Future Son of Overlord. It's by E. Nelson Bridwell, Ramona Fraiden, and Vince Coletta. The Super Friends are trying to stop various citizens who seem to have gone mad, thinking that they too have superpowers. What is going on? Well, the Overlord is what's going on. We see that via a monitor. He is watching what is going on and is the one behind it. He is convinced that everyone has untapped super abilities, and using his mind control powers, he can create an unstoppable army of super beings. Remembering Superman's moniker as the Man of Tomorrow gives him an idea, some jibber jabber about using clones from the future. Cut to 1 month later, and we see that Overlord now has clones he has just created. One from 100,000 years from now, the second 1 million years from now, and the third 1 billion years from now. Back at the Hall of Justice, Batman reveals to Aquaman and the Wonder Twins that he has learned that the Overlord, who they thought the Super Friends had defeated a few years ago, is back, but the name has been taken by somebody else. At the Overlord's HQ, we see that his clone slash descendant named Futuro, a hulking behemoth, is ready to serve his master. Moments later, Futuro arrives at the Hall of Justice and does battle with the Super Friends, where he makes quick work of them thanks to his super fast reflexes and extra strength. But when Zan, of all people, lands a punch, Futuro gets worried his powers are slowing down and departs. Regrouping, the Super Friends determine the best way to defeat Futuro, who can see into the future, therefore knowing what his enemies will do before they do it, is to act completely illogically. So when Futuro returns, the Super Friends ignore him, continuing their card game, using a combo of elements that Futuro is susceptible to and prank-like retaliations, he is knocked out. Back at his HQ, Overlord is dismayed that Futuro was so easily defeated, but is hard at work working on his next other set of clones. Okay, Devin, do you agree with my sense that this story was way too complicated for its own good?
It's like three different high concept ideas that could be a full issue very easily, and he just uses all three of them. Like, mm-hmm. I like the idea of someone tricking normal humans into thinking they have powers, and of course, you know, the Super Friends have to save all of them. Like, that's a whole issue. I don't know why. Like, it resolves in two pages.
Yeah.
and then, you know, the second one of them, of someone who's like so clever he can anticipate everything they're going to do, so they can't really fight him. That's another good idea for an entire issue. And then, you know, the idea that's actually on the cover of them being sort of silly and illogical and sort of tricking him up, that's like kind of another idea. So, you know, and even, you know, the whole clones from the future thing, like you could these days you could do like a 12 issue series on that or something.
But, Yeah, I feel a little ashamed to admit this, but as I'm writing this synopsis for what is a 40-year-old children's comic, I got tired. You know, I got tired just having to write all this stuff up, because as you say, there's like three separate ideas here in like this 18-page story. Now, again, you got to give ENB credit for cramming as much plot into a 50-cent comic as he could, but it is a little overstuffed. You know, it is almost just like, wait, okay, then there's this, then there's this, then there's this. Cause like, I mean, that opening sequence again, with like the normal humans who think they have powers, and because they think they have superpowers, they've been sort of tricked into it. I mean, they do have powers. I mean, the one guy is in the splash page is flying. He's not fooling himself. He actually is flying.
And the dude's lifting the building, like, for real. And mm-hmm. Batman's like, oh, you're going to hurt yourself. Like, be careful.
Yeah. and then we see, you know, this is being monitored by the Overlord. And his whole inspiration is that bit about the woman whose child was trapped under a car. And supposedly that's like a thing from real life, where this woman had, you know, showed a tremendous strength because she was able to lift the car off of her child in a way that, of course, she should not be able to do, but they talk about it was her adrenaline. That is quite literally the same beat that Bill Bixby pulls from in the Incredible Hulk TV series. I mean, that's it's right. The same exact data point as well. So this is all one giant universe.
Of course.
Yeah. So Overlord, what's the, in your mind, what's the over under on Overlord here with this ridiculous costume that he's got?
Well, I like how he's wearing a fur cape and his world hat. And then when he goes in to do his science, he goes to a locker room, takes off his cape and his hat and puts on a lab coat, you know, because you don't want to get, you know, chemicals and science stuff from your clones all over your nice cape. So if I remember correctly, like the other guy, the guy that he set up in the previous issue right. had been wearing that same costume. So yep. he's just sort of like, now I'm really being myself. So I'm going to wear my crazy costume, even though there's like no minions around to like be impressed by it or anything like that. But it's a strange thing. And to also have, he spends an entire month doing it and the super friends are kind of hanging around the entire month going, yeah, well, that was weird when those people were all messed up like that. Like,
you got, look, they're the super friends. They see a lot of crazy shit, you know? I mean, you yeah. can't, you know, it takes a little bit to impress them. Again, I love by page, right? We're at page five, right? We're at page five and we're 1 month later into Overlord's plan. And he just so casually mentions that he's managed to pull, I mean, they're clones, but they're also descendants, which is a weird thing. But as I said, there's one is from 100,000 years from now. Right. Okay. That's pretty impressive. A million years from now. And then 1 billion years. Like, what?
Like, so he's got a machine that makes clones, which is one thing. He's also got a machine that can evolve these clones somehow using like forces or something. But plus, he comes out with a baby and he's able to age it up. Like,
yeah.
That's like three amazing inventions right there yeah. that he's just sort of casually putting together. It's like, well, I need to have someone to attack the super friend. So I need to do all these things. Like,
and I don't,
if I'm not mistaken, he says he's from the DNA project, which I didn't know if that was a thing, but I kind of looked it up and that's actually like what they, in the '70s, they called, what I'm more familiar with as the Cadmus project and, mm-hmm. you know, the Superman Kirby stuff. So that's apparently referring to like, you know, the whole DNA aliens and that kind of stuff from that Kirby stuff. Which I was surprised that they would pull that out and then not have like a footnote mentioning, oh, you know, you can hear more mm-hmm. about this on whatever comics. Although it's supposedly first appeared in Jimmy Olsen 133. And I looked through there and I didn't see any reference to the DNA project. So I'm not sure where that connection came from.
Everything is pulled from somewhere when it's ENB, you know, every yeah. single thing. Did you feel like I did on page six where we see the baby with the giant head and the kind of like glassy stare? Is a little creepy. It's, you know?
It is. If you look too closely at it, that is pretty horrifying. Like, I've made a baby and now I'm going to do things to him. Like, ugh.
Yeah, it's not you're being
somehow grow or, him. Yeah.
Yeah. Nurtured in any way. It's just kept in a glass tube. And there's something about the way Ramona draws. It's like dead eyed stare. That is just very upsetting for what is getting meant to be a children's comic.
And he somehow genetically made sure that the clone respects him. Yeah. You know, and like, okay.
Well, that's the only way he's going to get any. Yeah. I mean, the only way he's going to get any respect is if he
yeah.
genetically breeds it into them. Cause otherwise, not really working. Art wise, I should say, and because, you know, we know that ever since Vince Coletta took over the inking, I kind of ding him every month cause I miss Bob Smith so much, which you can see on the cover, but some months clearly, Vince took his time. And I think this is another one of those. I think, his inking line for Ramona looks a lot more lush than it normally does. I think you see a lot more backgrounds. Like they're just, there aren't as many of those panels where it's just empty nothingness. So I think for this one, he probably had a little more time or put a little more effort into it. So I think it actually looks quite nice. How are you on Ramona Freight? Are you a fan of her work?
So I've been reading along and enjoying the Super Friends comic and podcast and everything. So that's mostly how I know specifically her work. But I've said it before that I've considered myself somewhat art blind. Like I can't really tell the difference between like what like experts think is like good art and bad art. Like when you say, well, the inking is good this month, and I'm like, how could he possibly know that? Like it doesn't make sense to me. Like, yes, I think it looks good, but I kind of thought the previous ones looked okay too. So it was like I don't really, it's not one of my superpowers is to understand like that kind of like criticism.
Gotcha.
So yeah, I'm interested in thinking, you know, finding out what it is that is better about this and worse about the others, you know.
For me, just the way I look, I mean, first of all, Ramona Freyden, I mean, I love Ramona Freyden, you know, I mean, just love her figure work, love her panel layouts, love her sense of movement. And I think there's something about her style that is perfectly paired with Bob Smith. I think Bob Smith his ink line has a just like a fluidity to it that I think pairs up very well with Ramona Freyden. And Coletta, to my eye, often for most of the pencilers that he's inked, his lines are very rigid and a little blocky. And I think it tends to make the figures feel very stiff. And I think when you pair him up with someone like Ramona Freyden, who to me is extra on the fluidity side, it's not a good pairing. And there are some issues of Super Friends where it looks like her figures, which normally to me are very lush and very smooth, look very stiff. And I'm like, well, that's Vince kind of stiffening them up. And then on the background front, we all just know that he frequently deleted a lot of backgrounds because he just wanted to get it done. And he would erase the work of the penciler. And, but I don't see that here. I mean, just last month we talked about there's like one whole page where there's no backgrounds. The Super Friends are just sort of moving around in empty space. But here, virtually every panel has something where, you know, maybe there's a headshot or whatever, but it just to me, there's a lot more fullness to it. And so that's how I sort of pick it up. Now, a lot of other people really like Vince Coletta and he's inked Kirby and certainly inked a million other people, but because we've got the covers by Ramona and Bob Smith, there's a direct, to me, you can directly compare them. But, you know, like I said, I give Vince a hard time in previous episodes. So when he does a nice job, I feel like it's worthy to point out.
Oh, that's cool. When you say it, I understand it, but I can't see it. So,
right.
Like I can't see it outside of your explanation, but I can definitely see, you know, there's so many more details here, like on the Overlord's lab has all these stuff behind him and, you know, the water that Aquaman's swimming in, which by the way is actually Xan, and that's creepy.
Right.
And then like even the floor behind them has sort of like some texturing, I guess. So, yeah, I see what you're saying with that. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for that explanation.
There you go. So like I said, we have Aquaman doing training and he is swimming in Xan, which is, you know, well, unfortunate, you know, but I like that. I, you know, anytime they give Aquaman something to do, or ENB always tried to spread the wealth around, but Aquaman always sort of had to come up a little short sometimes. It's just the nature of the storylines. So anytime, you know, we specifically have something that Aquaman is doing, I'm always happy with it. So it's cool. All right. He's helping train the Wonder Twins. It's great. And then we see this, we're back to the lab and we see the first club. By the way, I kept calling him Futuro, which is wrong. It's Futurio. There's an Futurio, I in there. Yeah, I kept saying it wrong. I apologize, everybody. The Futurio, like it's interesting because like he has the giant chrome dome head, and that's always seems to be shorthand for the future. That like in the future we will all have giant domed heads. I don't know why that is. Why, I mean, you know, 100,000 years ago, humans didn't have smaller heads, I don't think.
Well, he's got maybe a super evolved brain. He's got a much bigger brain, so he needs
top
of the skull.
I guess so. What do you think of his outfit, his magenta and white outfit?
It's kind of just like Overlord's, but it's got a big F, which is like is he trying to like hide the connection here, or is he just saying like, you know, I'm going to send my best guy after the Super Friends because someone's going to pick up on the resemblance, I think.
Right.
But also, I like the collar. Like that's it's high and a weird shape for no particular reason.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, there is no reason to give him a supervillain costume. Really?
Yeah.
But they just do because we have to, because it's a comic book and, you know, he's a supervillain. So, okay. I do find it. I mean, you know, he calls Overlord father, which is technically correct. I mean, but he's a clone. Like it's, yeah, I mean, he's his father in a sort of, I guess, spiritual sense, but
yeah,
not, I mean, exactly. I guess
that's part of his programming, I guess, because he mentioned it earlier, but like,
yeah,
that's weird.
Yeah. So then we cut back to the whole Justice and the Super Friends are comparing notes, and Futurio just walks in again. The Super Friends really need to work on their security because supervillains can just walk right in. And, you know, he talks very officiously, you know, Batman talks about how Overlord is going to strike at them. And he's like, a brilliant deduction, Batman. And then he goes and he fights Superman. And there's this a bunch of panels where, you know, Futurio is able to pretty much easily defeat the Super Friends. He's able to smack Superman and Wonder Woman away and then punch Batman as he's attacking. And that leads to a moment where this, I love the panel. It's page 11 of the story where Futurio has attacked them all. And then you've got this panel where the five Super Friends are regrouping and talking. And I love that, like, they're clearly standing around talking. So, like, what's Futurio doing? Is he just standing off to the side? Like, just let me know when you're ready, guys.
Yeah, that's, well, I guess that's his thing. It's like he reacts to what they do, but he's not really trying to attack them per se. Cause he, like, even in the previous page, it's Superman that goes after him immediately and right. He punches him away. So he didn't actually even do anything except break into the Hall of Justice technically at this point, and they attack him. And in one panel he punches Superman, and the next panel he punches Batman in the head and doesn't kill him. So
right.
That's interesting.
And then that leads to this 2/3 page panel, which I really love. And it's definitely going to be in the gallery, of Futurio taking them all on. Superman misses. He overshoots Futurio because Futurio ducks out of the way. He punches Batman in the gut, which probably hurt really bad. He moves the way out of Robin. He punches Wonder Woman in the face, which is amazing. And then in a most ignominious style, kicks Aquaman in the chin with the heel of his foot, which is a little humiliating for the Sea King.
Yeah, I think I like the issues of the comic and the episodes of the show where everyone fights all at the same time, like kind of a little bit better than when they split up and go off on their different missions and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's cool to see a fight with all of them in the same panel, and then another one where they're just sort of piled on top of each other.
That's they do. We've been talking about that the last couple issues of the Super Friends. They've been made to look kind of stupid.
Yeah.
In the last bunch, because they've kind of been like a lovable mob, or like they got in the way of Plastic Man or whatever. But yeah, that the next panel where he literally just piles them all on top of each other. It, I feel like you can hear it's like got like that Hanna-Barbera whoa music. Oh my God. And I love that how angry Zan gets. We've been held back long enough. Jaina, it's our turn to tackle that brute. Come on. And even, Jaina's like, wait. And he's like, no. He's like, Zan is too angry. I love that Zan's got a little bit of peak going on. That's cool.
Well, and there's sort of two things happening to Futurio at the time, because he seems to be affected by the air. And so he's gasping. And that's why partly why Zan's able to punch him. But I also felt like, and it's not really explained fully, the fact that Zan ran off illogically without thinking is what kind of gave them the idea to what they do later. Like, it confused him, just because, like, why would you punch me? You're just a regular dude. You're not even like a nice guy right now.
I dig it. I like it. Again, it's relatively subtle, you know, for a kid's comic. And again, at an 18 page story, we've got to barrel through it. But then Futurio takes off because he realized, he said he's been sort of, you know, like, wait a minute, that was illogical that you do that. So, and he realizes his powers are weakening. And so Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and everyone, they kind of regroup. They figure out all the stuff with the elements, the nitrogen. I mean, this was the page 13, where I started to write the synopsis. And I just got like, I can't write all this. This is just really complicated.
Yeah, and of all things for them to think, oh, it must be something in the air, like a trace element. Well, it could be like a lot of things.
Yeah.
Like, if it could be like radiation. I don't know. Like, he's allergic to the sun. Like, who knows? Of all the different things that happen to people with powers, like, that one weakness they kind of think of, and they're absolutely right.
Right, yeah. And then we cut to a little bit later, and Futurio is marching back into the Hall of Justice. By the way, I love the way Ramon Afraid draws him, where he's kind of just walking fast. He's just very angry. Yeah. I'll show them. And he's got his oxygen tank. Now, of course, I mean, I guess he got that from the Overlord, because, like, he's a giant. I mean, he can't just get that at a regular store or anything.
Yeah, it says, and in due time, it doesn't say how long it was. So he might have gone back to his dad and said, hey, I really need a tank here or something like that. He's like, well, I'll fashion you one because I'm a scientist.
I need a giant one, you know, because your face is much wider. So then he walks right back into the Hall of Justice. And that's our cover moment, where the Super Friends are sitting around playing cards. And that's the cover. Really, it's just kind of that one moment. I mean, they continue to play cards for like the next couple of panels, but generally you think from the cover, that's going to be like sort of the crux of the story. And it really isn't. It's kind of just like a last minute, like, oh, okay, we're going to act weird, and that's going to throw Futurio off.
Yeah. I mean, to me, if I'm the editor and I get that cover and I've got this story, I think, wait a minute, we gotta put that cover in here because it's awesome. Like,
yeah.
But have them doing all that other crazy stuff. Like playing cards is kind of funny, but like, it's actually so much better to have them doing these weird things and totally being obnoxious to him.
Yeah. Right. I mean, they are right. They Batman is not, in fact, reading a comic book, or right. Wonder Woman is not knitting, or Robin is watching a movie. They're actually all just playing cards. And then again, they all act illogically, where Jaina turns into a bird and goes after the hose to his air tank. Aquaman splashes Futurio with some seltzer. Again, now we're kind of like, we're going to like a sort of a kid's thing, you know, where like, it's like a Scooby-Doo kind of thing. And then Robin shoots Futurio with a slingshot. And then he gets
with pepper.
With pepper, right? He gets pepper in his eyes, and that throws him off. Superman whisks around and grabs the tank out from under him, and then makes Futurio's eyes, which we saw earlier, get like super large and super irritated, which by itself is creepy. And it recalls the bait, what he looked like as a baby, with those kind of really creepily large eyes. But here he's got big red eyes, and it's just a little unsettling.
And I guess his eyes are vulnerable to irritation because he's just he has regular eyes, not because he's like some future clone. I don't get the exact connection there. Because like they figured out my weakness as my eyes.
Okay.
One thing I thought Superman was just kind of messing with the air tank, but he actually swaps it out for a tank of xenon and then argon. So I thought that was interesting that he's actually going to all the trouble to like, you know, trick him into, you know, continuing to use the gas mask with the new tank that they had lying around that looked the same, or I think.
Yeah. Again, it was like, this is a lot crammed into the last couple of pages. We even get with a footnote where Futurio is breathing this in and he realizes he can't breathe. And Robin goes, which of the noble gases was it? And that leads to a little footnote, a term used for certain gaseous elements, which are inert or nearly so. Small traces of most are present in the air, Julie. So, all right. Thanks. Yeah. Learning these things.
My limited knowledge of high school chemistry suggests that like those gases shouldn't be poison really to anything, because that's the whole point of them. But when they started mentioning xenon and argon, I thought, oh, are they really going to go with krypton? Because, you know, as soon as I saw that on the periodic table in school, I was like, krypton, whoa, how could that possibly be called that? So, it was interesting that they went there to, you know, teach a little lesson to the kids.
Absolutely. I used to pay attention to that too, krypton, because it was anything that would keep me interested in science classes. So I was like, oh, there's a connection there. Okay, that's good. But that knocks Futurio out. He falls face first onto the floor and passes out. And that's it. They've defeated him. And then we cut back to Overlord, who seems really not at all concerned that his futuristic son has been defeated and is presumably in the clutches of the Super Friends. He's just like, oh, well, I got two more, so I'll try again. And that's it.
And I mean, this is like a pretty complex ongoing storyline here, because it's been going on since like almost the very beginning of the comic, and they're just continuing to evolve the Overlord, and they've still never met him, I think, right?
No, they have not. And we've only got at this point only 9 more issues of Super Friends left to go at this point. As I mentioned, the book ends with number 47. So yeah, there's a lot more, you know, if there's any one character that E. Nelson Bridwell used as an ongoing, I don't want to use the word arc because that's a modern term that has no business with the Super Friends. But if there's one villain that continued on outside of, I mean, you've got Grax, you know, who would make 2 appearances, had a 3-parter, then came back for 1 more and got defeated. And then you've got, what was the animal guy? I forget, I'm blanking on his power. The guy that had all the,
Menagerie
animals.
Man or something.
Menagerie Man, yes. Yeah. So, but Overlord, if there's one big bad of the Super Friends, it's Overlord, sad as that might be.
And they do make a reference to like, oh, I wonder if he was the one who was controlling us that one time, which is, I think, back to issue 25 or something like that. Right. And so they make the connection without actually knowing. And, you know, at one point, Batman comes in and says, I figured it out. It's probably the Overlord. And like, he never says why. Like, how did he realize that?
Yeah. So yeah, it's a little too complicated. It's just a little too much crammed in, to 17 pages or whatever. So, again, I, you know, can't, really complain for E. Nelson Bridwell for giving you too much story, because my complaint about modern comics is that there's not enough story. Mm-hmm. As you say, this could probably be six issues in a modern book, but it is a little, it was just like, wow, there's just a lot of concepts going on here that just, we're just zipping by at a, you know, a million miles an hour.
Yeah. There's, I can think of a couple of occasions where like someone had a 12 issue arc planned out and they got canceled after 9. So they had to shove 3 issues worth of stuff into right. one just to wrap everything up. So it feels a little bit like that, but obviously not for anything close to that reason, because this is just how he wanted to do it.
You know, yeah.
It's the way he wrote and the way he thought kids would enjoy it. And certainly when you're spending, 50 cents, you want to get, you know, 3 whole plots in there.
Yep, absolutely. Now, who would you nominate as the best friend? Is there any one super friend that came off better than anyone else?
So I was first thinking maybe Zan, because he sort of gives them the idea by like attacking all crazy. And then he also turns into ice and Futurio slips on him. But then I was thinking, well, since Superman came up with the idea to switch out the tanks and kind of trick him, I thought that was pretty clever. And he's able to, you know, pull it off 3 different times without him noticing. So I guess I'd have to go with Superman.
That's fair. I actually went with Zan for that reason that you just mentioned, is that he is kind of the one that gives them the. And it's nice to say, I feel that especially of the two Wonder Twins, they tend to write Zan as the dumber one, which they mm-hmm. did on the cartoon. So it's kind of nice when he's the one who is leading the church, even though he's doing it for kind of the wrong reason. He's not thinking like in any other manner, the super friends would be kind of tutting him because he kind of like, you know, led with his fist as opposed to thinking it through, but it worked. So, you know, okay. All credit to Zan, but yeah, I agree. Superman also does a good job. He mixes all the chemicals and stuff like that. And he's the one that sort of switches the tanks and things like that. So yeah, fair enough. So overall, I mean, if you would, you know, you bought this comic off the stands, would you have walked away a little like, oh, the cover was, you know, not a bad comic, but the cover was the best thing about it?
I mean, I read it probably twice before I thought, hey, that cover doesn't really happen that way. Like, it's kind of like, it's still a decent story and it kept my interest, you know, but it was a little while before I figured out there's kind of not a connection here and it should be better in a way. So like, I can't really fault them for that, because if I was a kid, I would have just read it and gone on to the next thing. And, you know, I would have had been perfectly satisfying. But the fact that I've probably read it like 3 times in the last week says like, yeah, I can notice some things that maybe you wouldn't notice normally.
Taking time away from your job, your hobbies, family while you're sitting there rereading the story for the third time. So, and of course, we're not done yet. There is another whole story in this book, an exciting story starring the Wonder Twins, according to the cover cup.
I have one more thing that actually connects to my in-stock trades recommendation, because I was looking on Mike's Amazing World and they have the chronology of characters. So it says for Robin, like his last appearance before this was New Teen Titans number 2, which on the cover, which he's dead and he meets, that's the first appearance of Deathstroke. So he went from that to this, like to acting silly and watching cartoons on the cover of this one. And they were out like within like 2 weeks of each other or something like that. So like, I think that says kind of an interesting thing that the same character can have so many different sort of elements to him. But it's also kind of crazy that they were publishing like the same guy in those two different ways at the exact same time.
That is amazing to think of, right? I mean, the Super Friends is definitely the it's not the end of the era, because the era kept going, but the New Teen Titans was definitely the beginning of a different era of DC comic storytelling. And Super Friends is the symbol of an older style. And so, yeah, it is kind of amazing to think that they overlapped for a whole year. That you think about what would the kind of character paces Marv Wolfman or George Perez would put Robin/Dick Grayson through, turn him into a real adult, a real character with a sex life, you know, and all these other things. And here he is being the goofy, you can hear the Casey Kasem voice being the dialogue from this comic.
I mean, you kind of feel good for him that he has a chance to kind of relax. Like he goes back to Gotham City. He's like, oh, that was really rough in New York. So we can just be silly for a while and spend an entire month here on this issue and then go back.
I don't have to face Trigon all the time. You know, I can just come back and be silly and be Batman's kid sidekick. Yeah. So
are you of the belief that Super Friends takes place on Earth 1, or is it like a separate thing?
Yes, it's, I mean, it's Earth 1, you know, it's definitely all the continuity. I mean, the Wonder Twins. Now, I mean, I don't know. That's I mean, obviously, it's a similar Earth. Is it exactly like when I was reading Justice League, which I never missed? You know, my favorite comic of all time. When I was a kid, if someone had said to me, "Do you think that four members of the Justice League go off and have a separate adventure with Robin and the Wonder Twins?" I'd be like, "Is that the same? Is it maybe like you know?" But then, of course, you know, Hawkman shows up in this book, and Plastic Man, and the Atom, and Flash, and Green Lantern. Like, well, okay. So, yeah, I think it was like, yeah, it's like Earth Super Friends, and it's a blending of whatever other Earths E and B needs to use to populate.
Sure. Yeah, that's true.
Because Overlords never shows up in Justice League or the Menagerie Man or Grax or any of those kind of Mort villains. You know, they just, they take on the Super Friends and that's it. They never go.
Yeah.
But I mean, they do, you know, other villains, they do mention the Justice League and stuff like that. So, you know, Warhead wants to take it. I mean, Warhead mentions the new Teen Titans for Pete's sakes. So, imagine him drawn by George Perez. That would have been nice
over there. He would have made that head look cool.
That would have been really cool. So, okay. So, the second story, which is the Wonder Twins, the Boogie Mania Will Get You, which I thought was kind of a clever title. It's a play on an old horror movie from the 1930s that E&B would have been familiar with, but probably went completely over the head of most children reading this in 1980. It's by E&B, of course, Romeo Tango and Vince Coletta. The Wonder Twins, in their human identities as John and Joanna, are cutting a rug with their friends in the hip nightclub Jabberwock. They overhear two crooks trying to muscle the club's owner, demanding he sign up for their protection. The leisure-suited owner angrily refuses, but then the two crooks retaliate. They seem to be able to control the lights and the music of the club, causing chaos. Taking the form of a thundercloud and a peacock, the Wonder Twins see that the club's music and lighting directors are in with the mob and causing all the stuff in the club to go haywire, seemingly at the control of the mobsters. Changing forms yet again, they knock out the mobsters and the conspirators, giving the club owner time to call the cops. Order has been restored, the music starts up again, and Joanna goes back to dancing with a handsome boy who says he really digs normal blondes like her, if he only knew. Okay, all right, Devin, what did you think of this this slice of disco heaven?
So I used to kind of hate this kind of thing, but now I really like it. The idea of a mid-30s or 40-year-old comic book writer trying to figure out teen culture and and put it in, like, you know, a fun book. And so, like, he kind of, I don't know if he exactly gets it at all, but it's like he's creating a world here where these teens go to a disco and this is probably what they do to have fun. And then mobsters occasionally come along and try to shake down the owner. Like, you know, that happens, right?
Of course. I really love the club owner with his leisure suit. I mean, he looks like he could be hanging out at the Regal Beagle. You know, he's totally got that vibe to it. I love these, as you mentioned, you've got these like sort of 40-year-old writers imagining what a discotheque looks like. Like this disco, which is, you know, populated by mostly teens and there's some other hipsters here. Like this thing probably costs $10 million a month to operate. It's so deluxe.
Well, and if it's teens and it's open apparently during the day, I guess, but so no alcohol, which means they're not really making that much money. So these guys are coming to get a cut of the profits. It's like, and they go to the trouble to bribe like the two people that work there, like the sound guy and the lighting guy. Like, how much could they possibly be getting in, you know, protection money? It's like, I don't understand the budget of this place, but.
And the club is called Jabberwock, which, you know, what? Like, it's like it's kind of an obscure reference. I don't think for kids to kind of get. And for such a kind of like earthbound story, and that it's, you know, the Wonder Twins are in like a club and they're in a city. It's got kind of like the Wonder Twins doing their most sci-fi-y kind of things, where Xan turns into like an ice being, which is like reflecting all the light. Like it's one of the more sci-fi-ish concepts that we've ever seen Xan undergo in a story that is, again, kind of like that dinosaur story that we mentioned a couple issues earlier. It's got, these all have the tone of like a Hostess ad, these Wonder Twins stories. And all of a sudden Xan is turning into like a character from the Guardians of the Galaxy or something.
Well, yeah. And it's like, could he, it, he never uses that sort of power to turn into like an ice shaped person. And, but he does it twice here. Mm-hmm. You know, he's also a snowman later. So it's like, that seems like much more useful than most of the things he turns into. But, you know, I also from reading the comic, I gather that E. Nelson Bridwell was trying to be a lot more creative with his powers than they were on the show, where it was just, you know, he was like, you know, enough water to fill a bucket and right. maybe some ice and that was about it. So
right.
I do like it. And, I do like the different things they turn into, and Jaina turns into a giant firefly somehow, which I think it's like she can turn into anything she can imagine in the comic or that she's heard of, I guess.
Yes.
So that's also sort of a different, like a different take on her powers, which is kind of cool here because they just change three times during the story for no particular reason, but just because it makes sense and it looks cool.
It's definitely going again more on the cartoony side, and that like when Jaina turns into the peacock and she squawks into the microphone, which gives like the feedback, and they get the guy, and like there's literal stars shooting out of his head, you know. And then in the next panel, he's got his hands over his headphones and he's got the swirly thing, you know, almost like the when you know like Bugs Bunny would get hit in the head with a hammer, and it would be the little cartoon birds flying around. Like you could totally see this one being animated into the cartoon. In fact, again, even being more cartoony than the Super Friends cartoon would normally have ever gotten.
Yeah. And the lighting guy at the bottom of page six, he just looks like really, really he's into being like a bad guy and being evil, even though I think he was just bribed. Like he normally works there and he's just a regular guy. So.
I also love the one mobster's magenta beret. Which yes. I just think is a nice look, you know, just as unusual for officers. And then when Zan turns into not only does he turn into a snowman, right? He turns into a snowman complete with carrot nose, top hat, and scarf, which are not made of water. So where did all that stuff come from? Of all the Winter Twins stories, this one was kind of my favorite, really, because it was just so crazy. And goofy and silly, you know, like, if you're going to do it, just do it. Go all the way. If you're not going to give me Seraph and give me, you know, educations in other religions, do it up. Just do it totally up. And by the way, I love the final panel of them in their wigs. And I love like they have that like Zan's wit. Like he looks like a little Dutch boy or something. Like it's not only is he, you know, it's like the most old timey look imaginable.
Because he has to cover his ears, I think, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's wearing a wig, and it's actually kind of like a pretty bad lesson at the end. Like, hey, you're not weird. You're just a regular blonde who I really like. And Zan's like, yeah, you know, he doesn't even know. Like, like that's terrible. Like, he should actually like her for who she is. That should be the lesson here.
Well, maybe had they not given the final page of the story, one third of it to an ad. For Action Comics, they would have had the room to bring in that lesson. But no, DC had to get in some advertising for some Superman-related comics. So the lesson had to be cut short, Devin. I'm sorry.
Because earlier in the story, she's saying, well, maybe I'll just give up my powers and be a regular teenager. And he's like, no, you couldn't possibly do that. And of course, something comes up and she's like, you're right. You know, I need to fight crime. So her lesson at the end should be like, I don't really want to hang out with this guy. I'd rather, you know, be a super friend. But no, she's just going to like chill with him.
Yeah. Well, you know, she's cute for now, you know?
Yeah.
So love the one you're with kind of thing. So, yeah, exactly. So that's issue number 39 of Super Friends. You know, a mixed bag to be sure. but still fun in its own way. And it heralds, as I mentioned earlier, the final year of this comic. The Super Friends would end with number 47. So that's going to be basically the last 8 or 9 issues. I will mention it here. This show, as of this episode, is entering its final year. We will be wrapping up with issue number 50. There's a couple other special episodes we'll be doing after we get to the final issue of Super Friends. But this is like the last 8 months of the Super Friends. So let's savor all these, everybody, because these are going to be the last bunch of adventures we're going to get for this classic Super Friends book.
Yeah, and it was like a few years before they kind of returned to the concept with superpowers and did it totally different, like in every possible way.
Yeah.
So it's like it's completely unconnected in any way. And they make no reference to any of this in, you know, any of that stuff. Right.
Yeah, right. This thing is really its own thing. And when it ended, that was it. You know, it just kind of was like, oh, okay. It was completely disconnected. There would be mentions throughout various books over the years of kind of hints here and there, but basically in continuity, Super Friends is once the book got canceled, it was it. You know, this is the who's who. They never had a who's who listing, you know, which they should have because the damn book ran 47 issues. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at. But yeah, it's kind of like, it's almost like a weird little black hole where it closes in on itself and it just disappears. And it's like, oh, it's like it never even happened. So, well, Devin, I mean, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me about this issue. I'm very happy to have you on the show and talk Super Friends with you. I hope you enjoyed the process.
Yeah, for sure. It's great to have a podcast that talks back to me.
Do you want to tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I'm on Facebook with my name. I'm also on YouTube with my name, but I don't really post much of any of that. And, you know, sometimes I leave comments on the Fire and Water Network, so you could see me there, I guess, but that's about it.
All right. So, well, again, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. And everybody stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback. You
can take a racetrack wherever you go. Belt Racer can go wherever you go. It's a belt that doubles as a racetrack. By using the spring-loaded buckle launcher, you can send the race car speeding down the belt track. Each Belt Racer sold separately. Belt Racer. Belt Racer comes with everything you see here, each sold separately. New from Busan.
Are you tired of fanboy comics podcasts? Looking for a show that really appreciates the comic storytelling medium and how it works? A show that looks at comics from any genre and anywhere in the world, comparing the storytelling techniques of different creators in different comics cultures, with manga, newspaper strips, European comics, and more, discussed alongside mainstream U.S. comics. A show that includes talks with well-known creators like James Robinson and Dan Jurgens, and with less famous creators that you really should know. And hey, we'll even critique your comic. If you're looking for that show, then you're looking for Deconstructing Comics, and it's right here at deconstructingcomics.com. Also available in iTunes and on Stitcher. This is Tim saying, check out our show on Wednesdays. That's Deconstructing Comics.
And it's time for listener feedback. And these are the comments we got on episode 38 of For All Mankind with my two special guests, Captain Entropy and Henry Bernstein. And as expected, due to the length and content of the previous episode, we got more comments for that episode than we would normally get on an episode of For All Mankind. And in the interest of making sure everyone who was nice enough to leave a comment gets their moment here in the feedback section and keeping the section of the show from going on too long, I'm going to refrain from me sticking my individual comments in between the other comments. So we're going to get through this as fast as possible. So let's start with Matt Sorois, who says, fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Thanks for going so deep into the Seraph story. I learned a lot. It's great that ENB put the effort into being so accurate. I've always found it confusing that some folks will balk at not only religious discussion, but avoid experiencing anything of a religious nature when it comes to books, movies, or TV. They'll protest against the inclusion of the Abrahamic, I hope I got that word right, God in their pop culture, avoid faith-based stories, yet not bat an eye when a character uses a crucifix or holy water to battle a vampire. Ghost Rider, Damon Hellstrom, Spectre, and other numerous comic book characters are deeply embedded in superhero universes. Very few people have a problem with that. Thank you, Rob, Henry, and Captain, for exploring and educating. For the record, I am myself not a religious person. That's my personal choice, but I respect what others choose to believe. We can all get along if we choose to. Gus Cassays says, guys, what a wonderful episode. As a secular listener, not only did I not feel put off or excluded at all, but I had the opposite reaction. I was enthralled by all the data, discussion, context review, and general interest of the conversation. Also, Henry's glee at the fact that the story exists, but also the care and quality that went into it. It was contagious. Once again, representation matters, folks. Finally, what a great tribute to E. Nelson Bridwell. Each new detail about his work and life only adds to the awe. Although this network and podcast recognize him every step of the way, I do feel that he's an unsung hero and deserving of much wider recognition. Captain Entropy, who of course was on this very episode, left a comment. He says, Matt and Gus, I can't tell you how reassuring your kind words are. I can't speak for Rob or Henry, but I've been more nervous about this podcast than any of the other three I've been on. I want to discuss faith and belief systems, mine and other people's, and I want to represent mine well without being off-putting. The Apostle Paul even charged Christians to do that. Quote, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone, end quote, in Romans 12. But it's difficult to know where that line is, and I acknowledge that some of us aren't even trying. Anyway, thank you very much for letting me know that in your opinions, Rob, Henry, and I stayed on the right side of the line, and our conversation was worth listening to boot. Now I know how Henry felt when he found out that excellent podcast he and Rabbi Brandon share has a wider audience than he thought. He continued, followed up with another comment. He says, one more point. Matt says, we can all get along, and I agree that we can if we respect and value one another, and I think, as I think he's implying. The dictates of several religions, including Judaism and Christianity, are to love your neighbor and treat other people the way you would want to be treated. Lots of people who adhere to no system of faith do this pretty well. Rob is an excellent example. The least I can do is, as a person of faith, is to try and keep up. Matt Royce then followed up and he says, this is indeed what I was getting at. We don't all have to believe the same thing to get along. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Rob McCarthy says, depending on how one defines God and the universe, God's part of DC, since the Spectre, more fun, number 52. I don't think the Spectre does work for God, because why would God make him sew his own costume? But then I could see a God that says, don't cut your hair, saying, sew your own damn costume. Little Russell Burbage says, this was the podcast I needed to listen to today. I could see your smiles and hear the joy as you three discussed the Seraph story. Thank you for sharing your enjoyment of the story with us. I remember thinking of this as similar to the scene of the Spectre talking to the voice on several occasions, most recently at this time in JLA number 124, probably. As someone who's basically agnostic, I enjoy these scenes from a purely dramatic point of view. I do remember thinking at the time that the Seraph stories were mostly overtly religious, that made me want to read ahead and look at the next Seraph story. That one is by Bob Oxner, who also illustrated it. I wonder if he, as a Jewish man, had an affinity for this character, or maybe helped Ian B. with some of the visuals. As for the lead story, it was surprising that none of the Super Friends remembered Commissioner Gordon's comments except Aquaman. Good on you, Artie. Gene Popa says, another terrific episode. I believed for years that E. Nelson Bridwell was the great unsung talent of both the Silver and Bronze Ages, not only as a writer, but also as an editor and keeper of the DC lore. If the Fire and Water is looking to add another podcast, I would rejoice to hear a show dedicated to the life and work of E. and B. Paul Wildenberger says, and just like that, For All Mankind has become my favorite religious discussion podcast. Not that I listen to many. I am Protestant, but I love to listen to discussions from different belief systems than mine. Specifically, respectful dialogue where people come from different faiths are not trying to bully and berate each other in regards to what they do or not have in common. Bravo to all three of you for such a discussion. As for how much E. Nelson Bridwell put into each story, I wonder if he didn't have that Seraph story already written and was sitting on it until he had space for it. He may have seen the main feature as being light enough so that he could make a quick work of it. Ado Bosnar says, another wonderful episode of For All Mankind. Like everyone else, I thoroughly enjoyed listening to the deep dive into the Seraph story and the character himself. As for other topics, I have to say, I had to smile when he began speculating about the extent of Zan's powers. I recall that the Super Friends cartoon came up in a discussion among friends back in college, and we started joking about how Zan and Jaina never lived up to their potential. Ultimately, we thought that Zan could have regularly turned into the Pacific Ocean, or at least the tsunami, while Jaina should have become the supreme being, which circles back to your theological discussion. Also, it's completely off topic, but since Henry brought up Bernie Rosenthal, and I have to say, and I think I've mentioned it at least once elsewhere on this site, she's always been my favorite love interest for Cap / Steve. I think she could have become his one and only, i.e. the Mary Jane to his Peter Parker Spidey or the Lois to his Clark Superman. So I'm always up for a discussion of the character and look forward to any podcast that features her. Jeff R. says, even without approaching the divine, very few problems wouldn't be solved with the form of a Kryptonian dog. Dr. Hand says, I had this one as a kid, and I think I was perplexed by the Seraph story. I was an ultra-practicing Catholic at the time, knew a lot of scripture, and knew about stories of repentance. This one even seemed out of place to me. I vaguely remembered it and have been waiting to hear the discussion, so I can't thank you enough. Such a great discussion. Kudos to all. Brian Linton says, I like to think that Aquaman got the spotlight of the main story in recompense for being left off the cover. Also, the Seraph story sounds really interesting. I'll have to track this issue down. Thanks for another excellent episode. Chris Franklin from our network says, I had this issue as a kid, and the cover layout made an impression. Not only did the hero's actions recall JLA number 9, but the cover is very similar to JLA number 5. I think Chris posted the cover in the comments, and he's absolutely right about that. Great Seraph discussion, guys. I like the character too, and ever since Rob mentioned he should have been in the Warlord line, I can't get it out of my head. Just for posterity, the line consisted of Warlord, Machiste, the only figure I had from it, Hercules, Mikola, the wolf guy, Arrak, and Deimos. Remco also advertised the line with their own generic warrior beasts as well. I will admit the religious content of the story threw me a bit, but I was taken in by Spires Comics' own Barney Bear and their sneaky, preachy Archie comics that looked like regular Archies. But the stories are so good, I got over it quickly. I agree. E&B is a fascinating subject, deserves a book, a podcast, a biopic, anything. Someone get on that. Brett Young says, another great episode, Rob. Your and Captain Entropy's conversation with Henry Bernstein was fascinating. The Seraph story was deep and a bit shocking. I mean, who would expect the settlement's founder to be that hot? Seriously, though, a really thoughtful discussion. You should be proud of that. Speaking of death, Grax is back. This guy clearly has no sense of how to secretly gather a group of powerful gangsters for an evil meeting. Where's the big mahogany table with fancy chairs? Where's the high-end liquors and fancy glassware? Where's the dark mood lighting? Where's the obligatory violence against a doubting attendee to show everyone he means business? This place looks like Grax rented a conference room at the Gotham City Best Western. When the gangsters get away from Superman by jumping in the sewers, it reminded me of what I like about the Super Friends version of Superman. He's not going to go into a nasty Gotham sewer for a couple of thieves. The Super Friends have interns for this crap. He could just catch them later. This is the third issue in a row where the heroes look like a bunch of dummies. Good on Aquaman for actually listening when Barney Miller called him at the Hall of Justice earlier. Aquaman was the only one who used his brain. Not sure why that whale had lips, but I'm not a marine biologist. The security outside the Hall of Justice could use some beefing up. You'd think it may raise some alarm bells when a four-armed guy in his pajamas shows up with a big magenta cannon. But then I also wasn't aware that the Hall of Justice is beachfront property, so what do I know? But good for Topo destroying Grax's machine by getting it wet. If Grax had picked a rainy day for his evil plans, it would have been all over before it started. Also, what was his plan? Blow the planet to space dust with a machine that's sole weakness is moisture? Maybe just rob the Best Western first. Start small, Grax. Start small. Martin Gray says, another splendid episode of For All Mankind, and a bumper one at that. Thank you, Rob, Captain, and Henry. How can anyone say anything but hurrah for the return of Grax the Destroyer? Sorry, Grax. He's just a tonic to look at, the daft four-armed barm pot. This isn't the most exciting story, but the art just makes me smile, even when VC has rubbed out the backgrounds. I dare not type his name if her full fear of all the furniture behind me vanishes. The discussion of Zan's power was interesting. I wonder if he was given his particular water ability by the Super Friend producers because they knew he'd be able to team up with Aquaman, allowing the Sea King to show off his awesomeness more often. Like Ange, I was a good Catholic kid, baptized in Latin, Martino Alexandre, but regularly read my hardback collections of EC's picture stories from the Bible, so was familiar with the Old Testament vibe. That voice of God signaled by the shofar heard by Haim on the final page after his repentance. Now, are we sure that wasn't actually Mal from the Teen Titans in his hornblower mode? I loved all the Seraph talk and the strip deserved it. It was something special. I'd never heard this idea that Christians turned into angels at death, apart from, as Rob says, in the old odd Hallmark Christmas film. Nutty. Seraph also gave a new god his name, Seraphan, interestingly. Sean M. Myers, of course, from this network, says, welcome to the podcast, Captain Entropy. You did a great job. Can't wait to hear your one future shows. We always rightfully praise Ramona Freyden's work, but this issue had four standout panels to me. Panel two, the shot of Grax with his four hands pointing in different directions. He simply has never looked better than this. Page five, you guys talked about Superman's forlorn look on his face, but I love the smug satisfaction of the crook whose jaw is not being crushed by Superman's fist. Page eight, that great-looking Aquaman sailing over the crooks in the boat. I'm surprised that that pose wasn't lifted for some merchandise. Hey, Chris Franklin, this is your cue to tell me that it was. Page nine, the whale overturning the crook's boat and dumping them in the water. Normally, I like to be one of the first commenters, but I was on vacation and purposely stay away from all of my podcasts. Normally, I do not repeat things that the other listeners have posted about. In this case, I will happily make an exception. Your discussion about the Seraph story was fantastic, and this coming from a man who is either agnostic or atheist, depending on which day of the week it is. Your respectful, thoughtful, educational, and even caring talk about the religious overtones of the story gave me hope that people can be understanding of different viewpoints. The only thing that makes me very sad in realizing that we never got a who's who page for the most recent confirmed character in the DCU, God! Man, think of the incredible page Zoom would have made for him. Gene Hendricks says, always nice to be used as a good example, especially where religion is concerned. Thank you, Captain. One thing I'm a bit surprised that hasn't come up yet, even though people have mentioned the Spectre, since the character is co-created by Jerry Siegel and represents God's wrath, real Old Testament type stuff. Wouldn't the voice be considered the Jewish God? Bucky749 says, and the world just keeps expanding. Both your guest hosts were great, as always, and they did a wonderful job in getting the history and learn more about a religion. And then finally, Brian Rosen says, thank you for discussing the Seraph backup feature. I didn't realize there was such a religious connection. I'll be looking out for this issue now. Even though Yom Kippur was discussed during the podcast, I don't think the connection between the holiday and the story's title was clearly made. Looking forward to next month's episode. thank you all. I really appreciate the warm feelings that people had for that episode. I mean, I really wasn't worried about it. I knew that both my guests, Captain Entropy and Henry, are kind, thoughtful men, and I knew the discussion would be at a certain intellectual level that people of good faith, in every sense of that word, could appreciate. But nevertheless, people are not expecting deep religious discussion on a podcast talking about an old Super Friends comic. So I could see it might have thrown people for a loop a little bit. So I'm glad it was as well received as it was. And it was a thorough blast to record. And I big thanks to Henry and Captain Entropy for doing that segment with me. I really do appreciate it. And it was just a really fun recording, as was this episode for A Million Kind number 30. And a big thanks to Devin Clancy for coming by and talking Super Friends with me. That was a lot of fun. I had never recorded with Devin before, and then I heard him on Shag's V Show, and I was so entertained by his stories that I immediately booked him on to Super Friends, and I was so glad he was amenable to that, and I hope we can record together again in the future. So that's going to do it for this episode of For All Mankind. You can find the show over on Twitter at For All Mankind SF. All the back episodes are on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. And finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill, Stanford M. Brown, Gord Tolton, and David Gutierrez for their support of the Fire and Water Network. I really appreciate it. That's it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we look at Super Friends number 40, Menace of the Mixed Up Senses.
An FWTV podcast.